Biblical Claims. The fifth talk in a series entitled Biblical Philosophy was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 31, 2006 at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
It's possible that I'm going to get further than the outline that you have, so we may be off outline for a little while today, and I'll get it to you next week. I think I thoroughly confused some of you last week, so I want to revisit the question that we kicked around toward the end of last time before I move on into the outline. And the issue was, to what extent is it important that we learn Greek and Hebrew in order to study our Bibles, in order to know the truth? I mean, what's going on there? And I think a number of you were left with the impression that what I'm saying is that if you are not inclined to learn Greek and Hebrew, then you're damned and you're out of luck and too bad, you're not of the elect, or something like that. And that's not at all what I was trying to suggest. And I think the way to give you a better idea of where I stand on this is to look at a parable. In Matthew 25, I'm in a Bible study that was looking at this the other day, and I think this captures quite well what my perspective on this. I think it captures Jesus' perspective pretty well, too. This is in Matthew 25, verse 14, following. For it is just like a man about to go on a journey who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his own ability, and he went on his journey. Immediately the one who had received the 5 talents went and traded them with them and gained 5 more talents. In the same manner, the one who had received the 2 talents gained 2 more. But he who received the 1 talent went away and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. The one who had received the 5 talents came up and brought 5 more talents, saying, Master, you entrusted 5 talents to me. See, I have gained 5 more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful slave. You are faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. Also, the one who had received the 2 talents came up and said, Master, you entrusted 2 talents to me. See, I have gained 2 more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful slave. You are faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And the one also who had received the 1 talent came up and said, Master, I know you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid and went away and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours. But his master answered and said to him, You wicked, lazy slave, you knew that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on my arrival I would have received my money back with interest. Therefore take away the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. Throw out the worthless slave into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, a lot of Bible teachers go a lot of different places with this parable because it says talents. Some people are inclined to take it to mean talents, even though talents is a unit of money, not a talent. Because it says talents, people are inclined to see that this is teaching on money and what we do with money relative to Jesus and in our discipleship. Spiritual gifts, abilities, a lot of different suggestions are made. 2 things steer me very strongly in the direction of taking the talents that he's talking about to be the actual gospel message itself. First of all, we have to look at the context. The context, I won't take the time to do it here, but if we went and looked at the context, we'd see that Jesus is talking about his leaving, his going away. He's just finished predicting the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, and the disciples ask him, well, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of the end, and when will be the sign of your coming? And he begins to give them this information, this picture of how history is going to go from here. And it seems quite clear to me that what he's saying is, well, the time is a ways away. A lot of water is going to go under the bridge before I come back and any of this stuff is going to be realized. And he's painting this picture about the incredible delay that there's going to be. And in the parable just before this one, a parable you're probably familiar with about a wedding feast, and there are 10 attendants to the bride. Five of them take enough oil, given that the groom was delayed, and five of them hadn't taken any extra oil, and the groom is delayed, and they get left out of the procession and the wedding feast because they had to go try to find some oil. So the point of that parable is you need to be ready. Then we have this parable. It seems to me that what he's describing is he's going to be going away to receive a kingdom. But this is the light of the world who, coming into the darkness, enlightened every man. I mean, this is the man sent from God to deliver God's truth, all important, crucial truth to mankind, and deliver that to them so that they might know what God is up to and where they are situated in relationship to God's purposes and his plans. That's who this man is, but he's leaving, and he's going away to receive a kingdom. Well, what is he leaving behind? He's leaving behind, in charge of these apostles and ultimately every one of us who receives it, he's leaving behind this deposit of wisdom, this revelation that God sent him into the world to give to us. Well, that, I think, is what's represented by the talents. The people get a differential amount of it. And I think, and according to their ability, it says. And I think what that corresponds to is a differential grasp, intellectually, primarily intellectually, I think. It's hard to know how to define that. But different people have different capabilities, different opportunities, different education, different resources, whereby they can take this revelation that Christ has given and comprehend it. They comprehend it at different levels. And that's all fine and good, Jesus says. The question is not, what were you given, and at what level of comprehension do you have it, do you grasp it? The question is, what do you do with what you've got? That's the whole issue of the parable, I think. The one who had five units worth of comprehension got five more. The one who had two got two more. The one who had one in this parable digs a hole in the ground, hides it, and protects it, keeps it safe. Well, the question is, what is this five more that the one with five gets, and what is this two more that the one who got two with? I think it represents whether or not we do the business with what God has given us that he expected us to do with it. I mean, as our master, we are just the slaves, right? As our master, he had certain intentions for what this resource was to be used for. He gave us a deposit of revelation, a deposit of truth. What were we supposed to do with it? What we are supposed to do with it is do business and make a profit. I think what that corresponds to, and I won't take the time to make my whole case, but I think what that corresponds to is having the truth that we have, that we grasp because it's been given to us by our master, change our lives, have an effect in our life where it actually, to use other biblical language, bears fruit. We actually become wise because of the truth that has been given to us. The one exception in this parable is the one who was given just one talent of truth, who didn't do business with it and have it produce any effects in his life. Yet he's the one who dug a hole in the ground and protected it. I think the kind of person that Jesus has in mind there, that he's giving us a picture of there, is the kind of person that we meet all too often in Christian culture, who is as orthodox as the driven snow. They know their creeds, they know their doctrine, they know their Bible, and they will fight to the death to defend it and protect it and keep it pure and make sure it doesn't get lost from the world. that in the flow of history, that this doesn't get forgotten and distorted and degraded, and the truth is no longer kept pure. And they will fight to the death to make sure that the gospel, the revelation of God, is safely kept. But it doesn't change them an inch. There's no inner change. There's no inner transformation. There's no wisdom internally in their life that comes about from their encounter with and their doing business with that truth and that revelation. And the point of the parable is that person is going to be cast into the outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. And he makes this interesting claim, which Jesus makes a number of times in his teaching. Everyone who has, more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he does not have shall be taken away from him. That I think that strongly suggests that the person with five who produces five more, he had his five talents. He owned them. He made them his own. I mean, I think that's corresponding to what we do with the truth. If we make the truth our own, and we have it, and we possess it, and what's the evidence that you have possessed it? It changes your life. It changes who you are. If you have it, then more will be given, he says. But if you do not have, even what you have will be taken away from you. A very, very common phenomenon that you see in the people around you, your acquaintances, your friends, your family, are people who will respond very positively and eagerly to the truth, to the revelation from God when they first receive it. And they just can't get enough of it. And it makes sense to them. And it makes sense of their world. And it makes sense of their lives. And then there comes a time in their life where they face some kind of existential crisis. And one of those things that the Bible calls testing, where the matter is, do I really believe this? Or, I mean, do I believe this with my being? I've grasped it with my intellect. It makes sense. It rings true. It resonates as true. But do I want my being to be about this truth? And we're tested. Something hard can happen in our life. Something very, very interesting can happen in our life that's more interesting than the truth. Riches, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, success, honor, tragedy can happen where something I love is taken away from me. And now all of a sudden I have to make a decision. Do I want the truth if it's going to cost me that? Do I want the truth? Do I want to say yes to the truth if I have to say no to this other thing? And at times like that, people will often, that's the thing that sorts us out. And sometimes we'll say, no, I don't want the truth. God can take the truth and stick it in his ear. I don't want the truth. And what's interesting is when a person makes that decision, how all of a sudden that truth which seems so enlightening, which seems so illuminating, I should say, seems so illuminating of their life, made so much sense to them, all of a sudden becomes very unclear and vague and doesn't ring at all true to them any longer. And I think that's what Jesus is talking about. If we don't have the truth that's been given to us, even what we have, that is, even what we have been given, has been entrusted to us, will be taken away from us. It's all, in the end, a matter of my spirit, of my heart. It's not a matter of my intellect. So that's more than I needed to say to make the point that I'm making. But what I'm arguing is that the crucial thing is what we do with what truth we do have, what level of knowledge and intellectual grasp of the revelation that has been given to us in the Bible. At whatever level we have that, what do we do with it? Do we embrace it? Live my life in the light of it, make it my own, and do business with it so that it bears fruit in my own life through the transformation of my life? Or do I do something else with it? And the two options are to reject it, to ignore it, or the even more insidious option is to receive it and protect it for God and keep it safe for God. Become a champion of the truth, but a champion of the truth in such a way that I protect the truth without ever letting that truth transform me. And it's only the one who allows the truth to transform them that is a child of God. But everyone who allows that truth to transform them to whatever level they have grasped it is a child of God who will receive the judgment, well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of your master. So it's not the level of intellectual grasp of the truth that's the crucial issue. It's the existential, it's the doing business personally and existentially with the truth at whatever level I do grasp it. That's what's crucial. Where I was probably misleading is the question that I was answering is not who is a child of God and who is saved, but what do I need to do if I'm going to be a Bible teacher? And there I still stand. If you really want to understand the Bible in order to teach others, then Greek and Hebrew is vitally important, because that's what the apostles wrote, not our English translation. And then a corollary to that, I really think that good Bible teachers who have integrity, who have discipline, and who are interested in learning, and who have the humility to be interested in learning the truth and presenting that to the church, are few enough and far enough between that we desperately need them. And I would long to see some of you rise to the occasion called by God to that task, to that role, because we desperately need that. If we don't have Bible teachers, we lose our Bible. I mean, we can dig a hole in the ground and bury it and plant the infallible and errant Word of God banner over the hole and wave it mightily, but that doesn't do any of us any good. We have to use it. We have to grasp it in a way that we own it and have it transform our lives. It's got to transform all of Christian culture in order for us to become a force for good, for eternity. So I hope that's clearer. Let me pause just a second there for any comments or questions, or is it clear what I'm saying? All right, well, let's go on then. In the notes, I'm on page 5. I think I got up to the part that says three senses of biblical as applied to a claim or assertion. I want to talk about that. If I did skip over that, please feel free to read the notes and ask me about them. But I think I got up to three senses of biblical as applied to a claim or an assertion. I think this is really important because most of us have grown up in some kind of Christian culture where to call something biblical, we know that that's a good thing. We know that's what we want, is for something to be biblical. But we've never been really very precise about what we mean by that. And so I think it's important that we clarify what does it mean for something to be biblical, because, as I point out here, I think there are three very important senses in which something can be biblical, and it depends on what sense of biblical we're talking about, how we would interact with it. The first one, it's the stronger claim, the direct claim. A claim is biblical in the first and most direct sense if it is a claim included within what the Bible is expressly intending to teach or affirm. So, for example, Jesus is the Messiah promised by the Jewish prophets is biblical in the sense that you have explicit, direct teaching by the apostles in the New Testament that they believe that Jesus demonstrated by evidence that he was in fact the Messiah promised by the Jewish prophets. Well, that's clearly biblical because it's what the Bible teaches. Or another example, Jesus was raised by God from the dead into new life. That's biblical because it's asserted and claimed by the Bible. But you could go on to a second sense. A claim is biblical in a second, what we might call an indirect sense, if it expresses an aspect of the biblical author's understanding of reality, that is, the biblical author's worldview, even if the claim is never itself an element of the expressly intended teaching of the Bible. So, for example, there is an objective truth about any and every reality. You never have any biblical author make that claim. You never have any biblical author teach you that and instruct you that that's the case. But it's nonetheless a biblical assertion, I would argue, because I think every biblical author is assuming that that's the case. Now, making the case that they are assuming that that's the case gets a little bit more difficult, because by virtue of the fact that it's implicit rather than explicit, it's going to take a much more careful argument, careful argumentation, and much more subtle argumentation to make the case. Normally, the kinds of things we're talking about here, though, are so obvious that it's not even really a problem. You don't even have to make a case because it's just pretty obvious. But this one, for example, there is an objective truth about any and every reality. In a culture that's rejecting that on so many different levels and so many different ways, this is a crucial thing to understand. Is that to the extent that I am buying into modern American culture, I'm stepping into a philosophical paradigm that's already light years away from the philosophical paradigm of the Bible. Because the Bible just has this old-fashioned notion that there is such a thing as truth. And it's starting there. It doesn't even feel the need to prove that, or to teach that, or to instruct you in that. It just takes that for granted. Another example, language is a tool of human reason that makes communication between persons possible. Clearly, I think, the Bible assumes that that's the case, and it's using language all over the place to try to communicate its teaching, its instruction. So clearly it's assuming that, but it never teaches it. But if I were to present a philosophy of language that assumes that communication between persons is possible, then presumably, at least in that respect, I'm teaching a biblical philosophy of language. See what I mean? A philosophy of language that would be at home with the assumptions of the biblical authors, even though they have never presumed to be philosophers of language and explicitly explained to me what their philosophy of language is. Nonetheless, I could articulate a philosophy of language that matches their assumptions. And in doing so, I would call it a biblical philosophy of language. Interestingly enough, I'd be almost tempted to put the existence of God as one of these assertions as well. I mean, you don't really ever have a biblical author arguing for and defending the existence of God and teaching you, yes, it is true, God exists. But obviously it's assumed in every sentence and affirmation the Bible makes. So it's more there implicitly than it is explicitly. But it's there in the underlying assumptions behind everything they say. So I wouldn't hesitate to use the word biblical to describe a doctrine that God exists, or any of these other examples. But it's a different sense than saying it's strictly speaking directly biblical, because it's something that is affirmed by and explicitly taught by the Bible. And then I think there's even a third sense in which we could reasonably use the word biblical. A claim is biblical in a third remote sense if it is not incompatible with the biblical worldview. That is, if it's not incompatible with the understanding of reality embraced by the biblical authors, even if the claim could not be derived from assertions the Bible makes, because it is neither explicitly taught nor even implicitly assumed in any of its explicit claims. So, for example, most truths of the natural sciences in modern natural science, most of the truths of the natural sciences, assuming they really are true, the second law of thermodynamics, for example, is biblical in this remote sense. Not because it is taught by a biblical author, and not because it's implicitly assumed by a biblical author. They don't have nearly that level of sophistication about physics that they would be in a position to implicitly assume it. But the second law of thermodynamics is not at all incompatible with the worldview that the biblical authors do have. And so, because it's not incompatible, and therefore not by virtue of biblical authority excluded as possibly being true, because it contradicts the biblical worldview, then there's a sense in which we could say it's biblical. but understand the difference. All we're really saying is it's not incompatible with what the Bible with what the Bible is saying, not that is actually taught by the Bible when we make that claim. And it's crucial that we make the distinction, because just because something is not incompatible with the biblical worldview doesn't make it true. But given the concept of the view of biblical authority that I taught last week, given that view of biblical authority, to be biblical in the first sense guarantees the truthfulness of the assertion. Being biblical in the third sense does not. Yes, it's biblical because it's not ruled out as being true by the Bible, but whether it's true or not has to be determined on other grounds. Something like the facts of human anatomy would fit into this, into the more sophisticated knowledge of anatomy that we have today. So this is the controversy. I have a note here. This is the controversy with respect to evolutionary theory today. The question is it compatible with the biblical worldview? We know that evolutionary theory is not explicitly taught by the Bible, so it's not biblical in the first sense. It's in all likelihood not implicitly assumed by the biblical authors, so it's not biblical in the second sense. The question that still remains is it biblical in the third sense? That is it ruled out by the biblical worldview as being something that couldn't possibly be true because it's utterly incompatible with the worldview of the Bible? And some people would argue, yes, it's utterly incompatible with the worldview of the Bible. I don't personally think that's true. I don't think evolution is true myself, but I don't think evolution is true because I just think it's bad philosophy, not because it is incompatible with the Bible, because I don't think the Bible is saying anything explicitly enough about the origins of the world and the universe and how God did things that there's anything the Bible teaches that would automatically rule it out. All right? Questions on any of that? Adam?
I've seen several places something like the second law of thermodynamics being used as a supplementary proof for the existence of God in that sense. And I guess I'm seeing the distinction you're making in the sense of like there's something that's explicitly biblical, something that authors kind of do, and then there's something that's compatible. I guess I'm wondering, like, could you elaborate on just that compatibility? Because it seems like something like, you know, second. Well, like something like that, it seems like, you know, while it's not explicitly biblical, I mean, it just, that to me, it just leaves too much open kind of for the abuse of that in the sense of like, oh, well, I mean, anything you could almost, I mean, could say anything's almost biblical. Not that it'd be true or not, but I mean, in that third sense, it seems like it's such an open kind of qualification. I don't know, could you just elaborate on that?
Let's say that science came along and made the claim that we scientists can basically bring mankind into a state that they are immortal. Well, it seems to me that would be not biblical in the third sense. It would be ruled out by the worldview of the Bible, because the worldview of the Bible is such that all of us are passing away and subject to decay and degeneration, and the whole world, not just human beings, but the whole world. Does that help?
It just seems like there's so many quote unquote world views that you deal within like the biblical perspective.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Third section.
Right. Okay. That's a good question. I mean, if I'm understanding you, that's a good question. Oftentimes, the way we use the word biblical is, that doesn't agree with me. I mean, I know I've spent a lot of my life saying that's not biblical, meaning that's not what I have taught, that's not what I have understood the Bible to be saying. So oftentimes we equate biblical with our particular theological tradition. And hopefully, from what I was saying last week, that's not where any of us should be. Because if the Bible is the authority that I think it claims for itself, and certainly the authority that I think that it has, then all of us, in whatever theological tradition we're in, need to be prepared to allow the Bible to stand in judgment over my assumptions and over my worldview. I need to correct my worldview to bring it in closer proximity to the actual worldview of the biblical authors. That's what it means to be a Bible student, as far as I'm concerned. So, you're right that as long as we allow anyone to define biblical according to their theological tradition, then biblical becomes a much bigger tent than if we're actually trying to come to terms with what actually is the biblical worldview.
I guess what I'm addressing more is kind of the superfluous issues, you know, in the sense of, like, I smoke, somebody could say, oh, smoking's not biblical. And then they could qualify it by saying, well, it's not explicit in the Bible. It's not this, but it's this third sense. Mm-hmm. It almost seems like, it almost seems like that qualification is so big that it,
Well, I think their argument is there is teaching in the Bible which may not be explicit teaching that smoking is somehow morally inappropriate, but there is teaching that usually they go to the your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit stuff, and that the way they're understanding that is that. That implies that part of your moral responsibility as a human creature is to take care of the health of this body that God has given you, and to the extent that we know on other grounds that smoking is not taking care of the health of your body, therefore this is morally inappropriate for you as a disciple of Jesus. Now, if they were interpreting the passage correctly, I think we have to respect their perspective on that. If they're right about what Paul is doing in that passage, then they're right, smoking is not biblical. The question is their understanding of what Paul is doing in that passage. And I would argue that they're not even close on that.
I mean, it seems like so much of those kind of issues fall back onto that sort of thing, that they'll be in this second. I mean, it's just
But do you see a problem with that?
No, it seems like a hard thing to approach in the sense of, like, you know, in talking about that, you know, that issue. So it'd be almost like, okay, let's jump back two steps and look at, you know, what's undergirding this.
But right.
Yeah. I'm just a bit confused about
right.
that. So.
Okay. Sure.
I share a similar sentiment, and maybe I can say it a little differently, and that is, would you say that anything that is not explicitly or in the second sense remotely unbiblical is in the third sense biblical? I mean, if you can't prove that it's unbiblical, then it is in the third sense biblical somehow?
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, that does just seem like a huge, broad thing to say, well, this is biblical, and it seems like the Bible doesn't address it at all. If that's your point, is that even though the Bible doesn't address it, as long as it doesn't disagree with what is really true, then it is, in that sense, biblical, because it agrees with a biblical worldview that agrees with the way God made the place.
Mm-hmm. That the third category is only useful in the negative. To say that something is not biblical in the third sense is interesting. To say that something is biblical in the third sense is pretty uninteresting, because there's so many things that are biblical in that third sense. Anything that's true that is not, well, anything that's true at all
right.
is biblical in the third sense, right?
In the third sense, if something is determined, like it says, most truths of the natural sciences, if they're really true. So if you have this natural science thing that's hypothesized and we can't disprove it, then we assume we can say it's biblical. But if it gets proven false, is the moment it's proven false, if it really is false, then we can say it's not biblical.
Right. But see, the way that third category gets used, let's take someone who interprets Genesis 1 as a literal seven-day creation of the world by God. Okay, if that's the appropriate way to interpret Genesis 1, then on the authority of Scripture, it rules out any evolutionary story whatsoever, right? So given their view of the authority of the Bible and their interpretation of the Bible, it makes sense for them to reject evolution out of hand, even and not wait for science to figure out whether it's true or not. They're going to rule it out of hand because, as they understand the biblical worldview, that's not biblical. Evolutionary theory can't possibly be biblical. So in the negative, to say it's not biblical in that third sense is a way for them to dismiss claims that something is true without having to have it be verified one way or the other independently of the Bible. So that's why that third sense would be at all interesting to people. Now, the problem is, of course, we can use the Bible to say things are not biblical in that third sense, having misinterpreted the Bible. And that's the problem, of course. That's why we have to be diligent to study it with responsibly and with humility and all those moral characters that are absolute prerequisites for good Bible study. Melanie?
Do you have an argument for why a claim is biblical if it expresses the author's understanding of reality and not, like, why the author's understanding of reality would be a reflection of God's understanding of reality and not, like, second century Jewish?
Okay, yeah, good. Because that's a good question. Because in my understanding, that's where the authority lies. It doesn't lie in the words of the text. It lies in the verbal intention of the author of those words. That's why we can translate it into other languages, and it can still be authoritative. I mean, the Bible is just as authoritative in German or French or English as it is in Greek or Hebrew. It's just as authoritative, assuming the translation conveys accurately what it meant, because it's what the author intended to say, and part of grasping the intention of the author is to understand his whole pre-understanding that informed his concepts and ideas and statements.
Why wouldn't that understanding be... Oh, you're saying because it's authoritative, it's not second century Jewish?
Well... No, let me give you an example, and that this will help. It's not everything that the author understands that is authoritative. It's what the author understands that has informed his teaching. That's an important distinction, and I didn't make it here. Let me give you an example. When David writes a psalm and he talks about the sun getting in its chariot and riding across the skies, okay, we, you know, imagine going back and interviewing David. Okay, David, it sure sounds from this metaphor and this poetry that you have written that you believe that the earth is the center and the sun is revolving around the earth. That's sure what it sounds like to me. Is that the case? And I expect that David's initial knee-jerk response would be, well, duh, of course. Have you looked recently? And may very well just go with the phenomenon and say, yeah, the sun moves across the sky. But then let me talk to him further and get him up to speed on what my real question is. I mean, my real question, David, is there are two possibilities for what would make the sun appear to move in that way. And then I could give him the Ptolemaic version of the universe and the Copernican version of the universe and explain that both would lead to the appearance of the sun moving across the sky. David, were you taking a stand for or against Copernicus in this poem? And I think, in all honesty, we could say that David would answer, well, no, I wasn't. That wasn't my intention to enter into an astronomical debate and take sides on that issue. I mean, I'm just, this is a poem, dude. So it doesn't really matter what his own understanding of reality was as he goes about his castle or whatever he lived in, day by day. What matters is what informed his intention in the text of the scripture. What part of his worldview was implicit in that?
I'm not sure whether or not you're answering the question. So, Paul says, like, slaves, obey your masters.
Okay.
Is there... That could come from two things. It could come from, like, that... If that command could come from some sort of a biblical understanding of reality, or it could come from, like, the master-slave interactions of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Why, like, other than that the Bible is authoritative, do you have any reason to think that everything that the authors are saying, they're saying because it's the truth and not because that's how people live back then?
Well, okay. On that example, there's two ways we could go. I mean, we could get their worldview wrong. There are people throughout human history who have taken slaves obey your masters and decided that there's something about the fabric of the universe that requires that there be masters and that there be slaves, and that we have our assigned roles and we need to fit into our assigned roles. That's what Aristotle taught, and that's what much of the medieval church taught, because they were fans of Aristotle. So there have been many Christians throughout much of church history who believed that some people were born to be slaves, and so from their perspective, using my language, the biblical perspective as they saw it would be that if you were born to be a slave and appointed to be a slave, then be a good one. And that's the righteous thing to be. Well, there's no... Part of being a Bible student is being able to reevaluate what we understand to be the worldview that lies behind the statements of the biblical authors. We may assume that we understand it. We may assume that we know it, but we may not. They may be saying what they're saying for radically different reasons and out of a radically different perspective than what we think they are. And sooner or later, we're going to come across something in the Bible, and usually in that case, you're going to see an important tension in the Bible. On the one hand, slaves obey your masters. On the other hand, you have Paul, who said slaves obey your master, saying in Galatians that in Christ there is no slave or free, among other things, that there is no slave or free. Okay. Those are not contradictory. Those are not mutually exclusive, but there's a tension there, and I have to pay attention to that tension. Does that have any significance? Does that in any way inform what Paul is saying over here when he says, slaves, obey your masters? And then you even get more tension when you add Philemon into the mix. Philemon is a very interesting book because Paul's argument to Philemon is, you know, by all rights, you shouldn't... By all rights, Onesimus is your brother. And I know he was your slave, and I know it cost you economically to lose your slave. I mean, I know all that. I know how the Roman Empire works. I know how we think about slaves. I'd be willing to pay for him. It's not clear what he's paying for. It could be that his slave embezzled some money or stole some money, and Paul's willing to pay for that. And by the way, Philemon, it's not like you don't owe me your very life itself. He doesn't come right out and say, Philemon, you really shouldn't be having a slave. But boy, he's tiptoeing right up to the edge of that and saying, "This, Philemon, think about this for a second. He's your brother now. And it's one thing to have a slave, but to have someone who is clearly and unmistakably your equal in Christ, and to claim to own him now, and to be his master, and for him to be your slave, just Figure it out, Philemon. Well, that's Paul, who, and he has, what he said in the letter too is, I'm sending Onesimus back to you. So true to what he said over here, slaves, obey your masters, he's asking Onesimus to submit to the economic realities of his life in that time and place and culture, to submit to that and pay the cost if necessary. If you have to go back into slavery, go back into slavery. So he is asking that of Onesimus as well, at the same time that he's asking Philemon to, come on, Philemon, get some perspective here. So when he's talking about slaves obeying their masters, there's enough tension there with other things that Paul says that I think it'd be very, very difficult to make the case that Paul has an Aristotelian view. That Paul has the perspective that some people just are slaves and it's their divine obligation to remain slaves and be good slaves. I don't think that's his perspective. There's another place where he says, speaking to slaves, if you can become free, become free. 1 Corinthians 9, I think. So, I mean, clearly there's an explicit statement in Paul that he doesn't think it's in, that it's in metaphysical concrete. That once a slave, you have to always be a slave. That's not his perspective.
So in the third sense, the population of ideas in the third sense are all those things that could possibly be true until they're disproved.
Mm-hmm.
So if a guy says...
As far as the Bible is concerned, yeah.
Yeah, and I say, I believe there's life on other planets. Now, since the Bible is silent about that, I guess... we don't know. And until we've been to every planet, we can't disprove it. So it goes up on the shelf with the maybes.
Mm-hmm.
We can't declare it to be true. We can just declare it to be possibly true. However, if there's life on other planets and we should kill them all, well, now what, that idea is completely not true.
Mm-hmm.
We know that's not true. That's been disproved.
Well, what else would they be for?
Yeah. So, in looking at the quote unquote worldview of some things people say, it gets kind of complicated because sometimes, like David, when people are writing their experience and their subjective impressions of their experience, they can be very truthful with what their experience is, but not be interpreting reality correctly. David says, Ptolemy says, I saw the sun go across the sky. Yes, you did. If your point of reference is your own 2 feet, you saw the sun go across the sky. I can't argue with that.
Right.
We know that the earth turned, but we had to stand someplace else to prove that.
Yeah.
If the disciples were frightened by the appearance of Jesus because they thought they had seen a ghost, does not necessarily mean they had a belief in ghosts, does it? Or that ghosts were appearing willy-nilly among the population at that time. It's just they were so shocked they had no other explanation for it. That doesn't mean the disciples believed in ghosts.
Right.
And so,
any more than it would if we were afraid because we thought we saw a ghost.
And so when we get to... A lot of these seem to be peripheral ideas in that category that you and I were breaking a sweat over. But... When we get to something like, you know, whether or not they believe in ghosts or whatnot, we do see people getting all wrung out over these the things on the shelf that are in the bin of possibles, as yet unproven, and just beating their fist on the podium. There it is. There it is. And I'm thinking, how did we get there?
Yeah.
I mean, why does that category even need to exist?
Right. Well, for me, like I said, its only relevance is when you declare it in the negative, that you can rule something out without having to have science decide it or history decide it or something else decide it, if you could rule something out because it is completely incompatible with what you know to be authoritative, then okay, then we can rule it out. It's not true. It's not biblical, therefore it's not true, would be the reasoning. And I think that's a valid form of argument, valid form of reasoning. We have to be careful how we use it, because oftentimes our argument really is it's not in keeping with my theological tradition, therefore it's not true. But that doesn't cut it. It has to be not in keeping with the actual teaching, actual worldview of the Bible. Victoria?
Do you have any example you can give of something that you would say was non-biblical by the third example?
Well, I'm sure I could. But let's see. Well, that was not a very interesting example, but that we will one day be immortal. Scientists will one day discover the cure to death and will make us immortal one day. I just think that's unbiblical and therefore untrue. There are probably some more interesting examples, but I'm drawing a blank right now. But okay. In the second sense, back to Adam's point about the second law of thermodynamics. What is interesting about the second law of thermodynamics, however you cut it, I mean, I know entropy can be reversed. It happens in a corn stalk every day. I mean, I know all that. I've had enough physics to know that. But just because entropy can be reversed, that doesn't change the fact that if, in fact, the universe is a closed system, and by a closed system we mean you come to the end of it, and outside of it there are no energy sources outside of the universe feeding it energy and keeping it going. If it's a closed system, and that seems plausible, then what the second law of thermodynamics, it seems to me, has to necessarily imply philosophically is this creation that we are a part of, this physical world cosmos that we're a part of, has built-in obsolescence to it. It was not made to last. Well, there are some people's understanding of the biblical worldview that it seems to me that causes problems for, because take the classical traditional view of the fall. God made an absolutely perfect, everlasting, eternal creation. A couple of human beings made a decision to do something they weren't supposed to do, and then they fell. Well, and then we just sort of casually say, when they fell, the cosmos fell with them. Well, the problem I have is the casualness with which we say that. The cosmos fell with them? Creation fell with them? Do we realize what a cataclysmic event that would have been to go from a physics that was based on an unentropic physics to the entropic physics that defines our universe? A universe that is made to be eternal to a universe that is running down and degrading and is aimed at a lukewarm soup of tapioca pudding? I mean, there ought to have been at least a little pop when that happened. And yet the Bible doesn't even hint at any such cataclysmic event as the transformation of all the laws of physics all of a sudden, because Adam and Eve made a decision that they shouldn't have made. What makes a whole lot more sense, both in the light of physics and a straightforward reading of the Bible, is that the world was not made eternal, everlasting, and permanent, and perfect to begin with. It was made to be temporary. It was made to pass away. Because this wasn't the main event. This wasn't the main thing God was doing. This was, from the very get-go, only a stepping stone to what he was going to produce eternally. I'm not sure what category that fits in. But
so with the third category and understanding that there are a lot of things in the Bible that we probably aren't interpreting correctly for a myriad of reasons, we ought to be awfully careful to say that something is or isn't biblical.
Yeah.
I mean, that it leaves me thinking, well, gosh, you know, it's hard for me to make that claim at all.
You mean in the third sense?
Yeah.
Well, there's still those other two senses. Okay. And those are far more meaningful. And to talk about something being or being not being biblical in those first two senses can be.
Even in the second sense, you've got to be pretty careful.
Well, you have to be careful in all of them.
Yeah, well, the first one, hopefully, you can read.
Well, easier said than done.
Yeah.
I've had passages that when you take them out and write them on a card and memorize them, they mean one thing. And then when you read them in the Bible, they mean exactly the opposite. Because once you've taken them out of their context and you have no bearings, you have no perspective on what are we talking about here and what should I bring to this to understand what he meant by this. And so you make something up, and what you bring to it and make up with it has nothing to do with what the argument was in the passage that you took it out of, and so you totally get it wrong. And that's not uncommon.
Yeah. I almost feel stuck in like a catch-22 in that what's the point of even defining all these senses of biblical when it's almost impossible for me to assert that something is biblical because, well, how do I even know that I've got the correct grasp on it? And maybe that's because of the place I'm in and just my changing understanding of the Bible and realizing that a lot of the orthodox truths that I've been taught, you know, that I would consider biblical in the first sense may not even be true anymore. I mean, can we come to a place where of understanding?
Yeah, you can.
Make that assertion?
Yeah, I think you can. The confidence comes. Yeah, you'll know it when you have it, and you'll understand the basis and the warrant of your confidence when you have the basis and the warrant for your confidence. What it comes from is having pondered a passage long enough and hard enough, and faced the objections and faced the questions, not just that other people have brought, but you have tested it with your own objections and your own questions. You've hammered out every phrase, you've hammered out every clause, you've hammered out every word, and are just doing your best to get inside the mind of the biblical author. What are you saying and why are you saying it? What are you trying to tell me here? And there comes a point where an interpretation just clicks. I liken it to threading a bolt in a nut, for example. If they're mismatched, you can get the bolt into the nut, but you have to work at it. You know, you have to force it. But there's something about when your mind is grooving with the biblical authors, the interpretation, once you see what he's doing, every word, every phrase, every clause all of a sudden makes sense. It makes sense why you said that. It makes sense why you used that word. It makes sense why that phrase is there, that clause is there, because I see what you're doing. I see what you're telling me. And out of that sense of I'm grooving with the biblical author comes confidence. I understand him now. I mean, it's very much, the thing happens all the time in human communication. We get all kinds of clues that, yes, I'm understanding you. I mean, we get feedback that, yes, I'm understanding you. And occasionally, you get feedback that, no, you're not understanding me at all. I mean, situation comedy is based on that, where you're understanding a whole conversation, thinking that this is the context for it, only to find out that it was something entirely different.
And all of that can come even from us of little brain.
Yes.
And without the languages and without the...
Well, I think it can, but it, like I was saying last week, I think if we are not doing our own original Bible study, it would come if we are interacting with Bible teachers who will share their process with us, share their reasoning with us. Because we all have enough common sense to evaluate when an argument and a line of reasoning makes sense or doesn't make sense. On the one hand. On the other hand, if you are doing your own original work and you're doing it in the English text, one of the things I may not have emphasized enough last week, as important as I think Greek and Hebrew can be, what's far more important is just an appreciation for the nature of language itself. If I train myself in what language is and how it works, I can study the English text And I think I can understand it. I can understand the Bible. I don't need Greek and Hebrew for that, because I'm understanding paragraphs, not words, not phrases, but paragraphs, which is how language works anyway. And I can, all of our translations, any of our translations, are going to be accurate enough that I pay if I pay enough attention to the whole flow of argument of a book, it should begin to make sense to me. Not without work. It's hard. It takes work, but I don't need Greek or Hebrew to do that. Okay.
The confidence that you're talking about when you're grooving with the biblical passage and you believe that you have the interpretation, what I hear you consistently saying on even topics that you are, or interpretations that you are most confident about, is the most confident I've ever heard you is, I can't imagine a better argument for a different interpretation than this. If it came along, I would listen to it, but I have considered so many. So you're not ever standing there saying,
right.
You're saying, I am very, very confident.
Right.
Or, I think so. This sounds good to me, now, but when it's relatively new, this really seems right. I think it's important that people hear that that's what you said.
Right.
But that's your understanding.
Yeah. I mean, none of us are infallible. And there's all kinds of things that can happen psychologically to produce a sense of confidence that really is not well-founded. But in time, if I approach the text with integrity and humility, in time, even that will be shown up to me. I mean, that happens a lot. I mean, I'll get so excited because this passage that's hard, all of a sudden it's beginning to make sense to me, and I'll get so excited with having got what I think is the key to the passage that I kind of stop. And then I come back later, and there's all these clauses and phrases that I don't know what to do with them. Well, that's a sign to me that I'm not done yet. If I don't know what to do with them, I really don't understand the paragraph yet, and I may even be wrong about my understanding of the paragraph, because if I was right about my understanding of the paragraph, these things would somehow make sense. So either it's incomplete, my understanding, or it's wrong, but I'm not there yet.
I think this fits with back to the three senses of biblical, and it may just not convey what I'm trying to say, but I've wondered about this before. Just, I would say that from, I think, probably the first two senses, you can determine that the Bible is teaching that abortion will be wrong. But mm-hmm. then the question of whether life begins at conception, would that be in that third category? Or would that be?
Yeah, probably. Right.
It would change my idea of whether or not abortion is wrong any time, but it just, I think, to be honest, that look at it, and some people just say, of course. I begin to conception. We know it. Do people really know that?
And I think, in fairness, there are arguments that could be made based on interpretations of the Bible that may even challenge whether abortion is clearly wrong in the first two senses, in the second sense. I think it's incompatible with the biblical worldview, but you do have people point out in the Old Testament the penalty if two people get in a fight and they accidentally strike a pregnant woman and the fetus dies. Well, it's not clear whether it's dies or is prematurely born. But the penalty is not the same as murder in that case. Well, why? You know, what's going on there? And it's hard to know what that does and does not establish and what it does and does not prove. But in any case, there may be in the biblical worldview an appreciation for something that I don't see, that makes abortion not the moral equivalent of murder, for example. So I think we have to be careful. Even there, we have to be open that we're taking into account everything that the Bible teaches and everything that it says and everything that forms its worldview.
You mentioned last week and just a few minutes ago the idea about being good students of language. Can you flesh that out a little bit more, what that might mean? I mean, you talked about the difference between words and paragraphs. Can you give an example of what you're referring to?
Okay. Well, oftentimes we have a kind of a naive view of language where if you ask, what does such and such a word mean? What does dikaiosune mean in the book of Romans? And we pull out our lexicon and we get a string of maybe a dozen words, and our way of thinking is, well, it either means this or this or this, half a dozen or a dozen things. It has to mean one of those dozen things. Well, we don't even understand what a lexicon or, for that matter, a dictionary is. I mean, even in English, you don't find the meaning of a word by going to a dictionary. Why do you go to a dictionary? You go to a dictionary to get into the field of meaning of the word. But how do you know what the word means? The word means something different every time it's used. I mean, if you want to get into the fine tuning of its meaning, it's a unique meaning in every unique usage of it. And the only way I can know what the word means is by understanding what the sentence means. And I'm only going to understand what the sentence means when I understand what the paragraph that it's a part of means. So oftentimes we have a naive view of language where we, on the one hand, are unnecessarily enslaved to our dictionary or our lexicon on the one hand, or we have no appreciation for a field of meaning at all, and we just start making stuff up and let a word mean anything we want it to mean. I mean, that language is a process of creatively using our language, but using our language according to conventions that allow us to be understood by other speakers of our language. Another thing that I don't think we appreciate enough is that we don't all speak the same language. We all speak what we call English, which means there are marked similarities between my language and your language. But part of understanding another human being, part of interpreting another human being, is to learn their language, learn how they use their words, how they use their syntax, how they put their thoughts together. It's in learning their use of language that I am understanding them. So it's a dialectic. I can't understand you till I understand your language, but I can't understand your language until I understand you. And it's in that dialectic that we communication has to happen. And the same is true of any of the biblical authors. I only understand them by teaching myself how they're using the language as they're communicating to me, but as they're communicating to me, that's how I'm learning how they're using their language. And it's in that dialectic with the text that I learn what the text means. And probably dozens of other observations we can make about language, but oftentimes if we haven't thought a whole lot about language, we on the one hand, we don't appreciate how plastic and moldable and flexible it is, on the one hand, or we don't understand how much it is a question of conventions and that you have to stay within the conventions. And we have to strike the balance between understanding the tug of social convention on language and the creativity that every person uses when they use language. We have to appreciate both, or we're going to make outrageous claims. I mean, you hear this all the time, especially when somebody learns a little bit of Greek. They'll come to a Bible verse and they'll say, it uses the word agape, and agape means this. It can't mean anything else because agape means this. Well, anytime you hear the claim, it can't mean anything else because the Greek means this, you know they don't know what they're talking about. Because language, I mean, just by being an English language speaker, you know, you can't make that claim about English. It can mean whatever I want it to mean. Give me the right context, and I'll creatively use my language and say whatever I want to say with my language. Well, the Greek authors are doing the same thing. I mean, the biblical authors are doing the same thing with the language that they've got. And I'm only going to understand them by understanding their argument, not by nailing down an interpretation on a single word or a single phrase. That makes no sense. Okay? We're running out of time. I'll have a whole next section here to go, but before I go into that, maybe we should just call it an evening if there's any last, final question.
Well, I don't ask very many questions, but this one's really burning on my brain. I know I've been hanging out with this girl lately. I've been hanging out quite a bit. And I think she's a pretty good friend. Well, in fact, I say she's my best friend. And she's an awesome girl. She really loves God, and she takes living for God very seriously. She loves loving people. She loves Joan and Cash. And she is hot. She's so hot. She's got these like big green eyes, beautiful skin, beautiful hair. So Jack, I'm just wondering, like, would a girl like this ever want to marry a guy like me?
Well, I don't know that I'm not the one to ask. You need to ask a female. There's one sitting next to you.
Janelle, I love you very, very much.